The actor Richard E. Grant is bringing his stage show to New Zealand later this year, An Evening with Richard E. Grant. He'll be talking about his life and times and well-known roles, and also about his new memoir, which is shortly to be released, A Pocket Full of Happiness. And that title comes courtesy of his wife, Joan, who died last year. She was prominent as well. She was a voice coach and had friendships with many famous people, acting royalty and actual royalty as well. Theirs was a very close marriage lasting 40 years, and he talks a lot about her on social media still. When Richard told the world about Joan's death, he posted a video on Twitter showing the two of them dancing to Only You by the Platters.
Only you can do make all this world seem right. Only you can do make the darkness bright.
Richard E. Grant got his big break in the 1987 movie With Nail and I, which is regarded as one of the best film comedies to come out of Britain. 5 years earlier, he had moved to the UK from Swaziland, Eswatini as it's called now, where he grew up, and he had been a member of a theatre company in Cape Town. The movie featured a drunken weekend by two young ne'er-do-wells in the countryside, ending rather sadly with a Shakespearean soliloquy in the rain.
What a piece of work is a man! How noble in reason, how infinite in faculties, how like an angel in apprehension.
And the rest of the film featured fruitier language and spectacular mishaps. So since With Nail and I, there's been a long list of roles for Richard, more than 80 in film and television. Henry and June, LA Story, The Player, The Age of Innocence, Portrait of a Lady, Gosford Park, Downton Abbey, Game of Thrones. He's twice been the Doctor from Doctor Who, in cameo roles. Playing Jack Hock in the film Can You Ever Forgive Me earned him Academy Award, BAFTA, Golden Globe and Screen Actors Guild Award nominations. He's been part of the Star Wars franchise and the Marvel Cinematic Universe, playing the older Loki, the Norse god, the Spice Girls manager in the movies they made, and he's Sir Walter Elliot in the latest version of Jane Austen's Persuasion on Netflix. So he's not short of work. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. What would have happened, do you think, if Daniel Day-Lewis hadn't turned down the part of With Nail to work on whatever movie he had to work on? Because it's now impossible to think of anyone but you as With Nail for all the film's legion of fans. I suppose you would have found a different door to enter, but even so, what a beginning for you, really.
An absolutely extraordinary break. And he chose to do The Unbearable Lightness of Being instead, and I think that that title alone would have described the state of mind that I'd been in if I hadn't got that part, because I knew that it was just an absolute gift of a role, and any actor worth his salt saying those lines would have had a career launch. I've no delusion about that.
Yeah, that's very modest of you, but you are synonymous you applied a lot of talent to the character. There's what seems like a horrifying story in this day and age of you playing one of the most famous drunks of all time, with you as a teetotaler and the director insisting you got drunk before you played the role.
Yeah, final day of rehearsal, he said, because you've never been drunk, you have to have a chemical memory of what it's like. And I said, look, my father was my role model in that he was a chronic alcoholic. And he said, no, you have got to be drunk. So he insisted and did it. But if that's what he believes is informed my performance, I know that that is not entirely true.
Yes, I guess you could have played a really superb drunk without being miserably ill, which I assume you were from having had to drink.
Yeah, and I played a drunk in Can You Ever Forgive Me and didn't touch a drop. So, it's called acting.
It's called acting. So you've never touched a drop since either?
No, not at all. I found out when I was 16, went to have a medical test, a blood test, because I couldn't understand why I couldn't keep any alcohol down whatsoever. And then the doctor said to me, oh, you have no enzyme. So I said, well, which other tribes have a similar lack of enzyme? And he said, Inuits, Aboriginals, Native Americans, and Japanese people. And I said, which tribe has the most? And he said, the French. Now, whether any of this is true or not, I don't know. This is what a doctor told me, and I believe doctors.
In this stage show of yours, you take audience questions. What do people typically tend to ask you, Richard?
They may come at you, and they do, with stuff that is so left of field sometimes that it then means that you can go down a conversational, you know, rabbit hole that you would never have anticipated. And that is the improvisatory delight and sort of fireworks aspect of an evening like that. So that's what I'm looking forward to.
They must
not to say that you don't ask the firework, you know, crackerjack questions, but no. Just that, you know, I've been stopped in the street sometimes and people have asked me things. I thought, where the hell did that come from in a brain? And, you know, it leads to something. So I enjoy that.
They'd ask you things like why you have a statue of Barbara Streisand in your garden, wouldn't they?
Yes, or could they come and see it? And yes, exactly. Why do I? Because I've been a fan for 53 years. That's why. And it's my way of seeing her every day and, you know, keeping my dedication alive and strong in three dimensions.
That's been an incredible dedication, and it led to a personal meeting. It led to all sorts of things in your later life, too, with her, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, and she did. She wrote me an absolutely beautiful letter just a month before my wife died and said that she thought that the... She said, I'm obviously flattered by the devotion that you have towards me and my career, but, you know, your faithful marriage to your wife is the thing that is most impressive. And she said, you still remain, as far as I'm aware, the only person that has commissioned a statue of me or my head that's in your garden. So, you know, she did say that I was crazy to my face. And I said, yes, I know. And she said, no, you are crazy. And I said, happy to be so.
Your late wife, Joan, I mean, you were together 40 years. The idea of finding happiness, a pocket full of happiness, and each day comes courtesy of her, doesn't it?
It does, because I think 4 days before she died, she said to my daughter, and I know you're both going to be very sad, but I charge you both to try and find a pocket full of happiness in each day. And it's become our mantra. It's, you know, it's printed across the top of my laptop that I'm talking to you from, and in my phone and in my car. So when the tsunami of grief sort of hits you and you go into that unbidden trough, it's a thing that has really galvanized and helped pull my daughter and I out of that, trying to live by the mantra that she charged us with.
Yes, she sounds like a wonderful woman. Prince Charles came to see her just before she died.
He did. He got on incredibly well with Joan because she... I think more than anybody I've ever met is the most unstarstruck person, whereas I am completely starstruck. And she treats prince or pauper with the exact same honesty and forthrightness, or did. If you live a life where, and I know from being an actor, that you can sense sycophancy a mile off, and the fact that Joan was so the opposite of that, I think, is what he found so endearing about her.
He
and
said
that she could do accents, and he was a great fan of the Goon shows, you know, where everybody had hilarious accents.
He said, it's been an absolute honour to have known you, Joan, to which she replied,
I'm still here.
Yes.
It broke the ice, you know. It was so endearing because he sort of put his foot in it inadvertently in trying to be as compassionate as possible. And, you know, she absolutely got what it was, because people do say, you know, it's very difficult to know what to say to somebody when you know that that will be the last time you will ever see them. So that was a very humane moment.
Yes, of course. Well, you still tweet about her. Sometimes you feel she's still with you, and your fans have worried about some of your tweets. They've been raw, haven't they, some of them?
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, in the same way that the the book that I've written is no holds barred. It is the most exposing thing that I think it's possible to do. It's some irony that social media is the thing that has led to the publication of this book, because I posted a video on New Year's Day saying that, you know, she charged us to find a pocket of happiness in each day. And it had such an extraordinary response and feedback. And then publishers contacted my literary agent and said, would you write a memoir? And I said, no, absolutely couldn't consider doing that. My daughter said, I think this would be a good thing for you to do and would help you. And indeed, it proved to be so. The book begins with the diagnosis of my wife and then ends with her death. But then, so if that's the spine of it, it then yo-yos backwards and forwards over 40 years of all the adventures in between that. So it is raw, because that is what life is sometimes.
Of course. But your life goes on, and what a life it's been, actually. Extraordinary.
I'm still here.
I know. But extraordinary, yeah, and you're still a youngish man, so don't worry about that. But extraordinary meetings. For example, how you ended up in the Star Wars franchise. That's a phenomenal story in itself.
The audition process for that was that I got sent an 11-page interrogation scene, and it was very clear that it was from a B-feature, 1940s war movie. Because of all the references, and you record it, because you don't, the majority of actors nowadays, you don't go into a room with a director anymore. You record it on a phone or laptop or iPad, and then it's sent off into cyberspace, and you 99%, you never hear anything again. So when my agent called and said 2 months later, oh, you've been summoned to go to Pinewood Studios and they're sending a car to pick you up to go meet J.J. Abrams. I said, well, what for? And she said, oh, that thing that you taped. I said, I didn't tape anything for Star Wars. She said, yeah, you did. And I said, I actually didn't. So she had to resend it to me. And then I saw, oh, that is what it was. And then went in there. And I'd actually met J.J. Abrams when he was 24 years old. I was 34, doing Dracula in the States. And he had a 3-picture screenwriting deal, and he had a movie called Regarding Henry with Annette Bening, directed by Mike Nichols, starring Harrison Ford, coming out at the age of 24. I just couldn't get my head around that. And he said to me, we're going to work together one day. And of course, he didn't remember that at all, because he was a keeper diary and got an elephantine memory. It's the first thing I said to him. I said, oh, you told me that we're going to work together. And he said, see, I told you. I'm true to my word. So that's how it came about.
And Daisy Ridley was there, who plays Rey the Jedi. But the scrutiny on set for that movie was stupendous, wasn't it? The secrecy.
Yeah. Fort Knox-like. I couldn't tell the name of my character to my wife, and she said, well, I've never seen a Star Wars movie anyway, and I'm never going to remember. I couldn't care. I didn't tell anybody for fear of getting fired. And they had, between the trailers and the makeup and the costume departments, you had to wear a cloak to going from one to the other, because, and a hood, because there were drones going over the studios trying to take photographs. And I know that the makeup and the costume departments all told me that they were regularly offered large bribe sums of money to provide any information that they could, because the appetite for Star Wars from people around the world was sort of frenetic fever pitch at that point.
Whenever you picked up a phone, though, someone would see and just check you weren't taking a photo.
Oh, yeah. There were security people everywhere. So, and to really give you an idea of this, to read the script, you had to go into a conference room. There were bodyguards at the door. There were closed-circuit security cameras. You had to leave your phone outside. And then the script was printed on a red background, apparently, so that you couldn't photograph that. And you were allowed to read it and then leave. You couldn't physically take a copy of it. And the days that I was filming, you got the sides, as they call them, the 6 or 7 pages of dialogue that you had. You'd get them in on the morning when you arrived for work, and there was, in bold lettering, it said, you have to return this at the end of the day or you will not get any the next time you come in. So you follow all the orders, like I certainly did.
People have wondered, you know, why you're so open about all the personal experiences in your life, including the deeply, deeply personal ones. It helps you stay sane, that level of honesty, Richard?
Yes. Yeah, it absolutely does. Yeah, because I had a kind of nervous breakdown when I was 42 years old. And what came out of the 18 months of psychoanalysis that I had was that I know what it is from inside out to live with the toxicity of secrets, specifically my father's alcoholism, which, you know, people drank in Swaziland, but you couldn't, you know, there was this sort of weird frontier that you couldn't cross of saying, well, my father is a violent alcoholic by night, because nobody else saw that apart from within the family. So I found that in being as honest as you dare, it has the effect of strengthening you and feeling like that is in itself a kind of, not armor, but protection, because there's nothing that somebody can then go, oh, well, you know, there's this that they know, because you've blasted it out in the first place. Mm. I don't know whether that makes sense to you, but that's what it feels like.
Yeah, no, I understand.
So for me, secrets are toxic.
I'm getting the big end of interview voice. So, Richard, thank you. We're looking forward to your tour down here and the nights people will spend with you. And thanks for giving us your time.
Thank you so much.
Richard E. Grant.